Hey guys, Timothy Roberts here. In this episode, I sat down with Ray Byrne from Byrne Cymbals, and we talked about a lot of stuff, but I wanted to give a plug before we jump into this this episode about his app that he has on Apple. So you got to have an iPhone for this, but it is called the Cymbal Builder app, and Ray basically made it. It's for the community of drummers, for people interested in cymbals to be able to check out and conceptualize the shape and the makeup of a cymbal. So you can go into the app, type in the weight, type in the diameter, you can adjust the profile of it, you can choose the type of bell you want. And I find it's a really great way of being able to visualize things and a way of being able to essentially come up with what kind of cymbal do you want. And then from there, you can obviously have a chat with Ray or another cymbalsmith about the makeup and what kind of sounds would you get if it was shaped like this with this kind of bell. It's really a cool app, and I've had it on my phone for years. So check that out. And without further ado, let's get to the episode. This is the Reverie Podcast with Ray Byrne. I've been an admirer of you for years. I think when I got into it and started doing research as to who was out there doing this, you were one of the names and one of the people that I think struck me first off of, like, he makes cymbals like I want to make. And I'm interested to talk with you and get kind of your backstory. And I know a little bit about it from research I've done, but I'd rather hear it from your mouth.
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. Thanks for the kind words. Yeah.
So I played your stuff too. And we met in Nashville. Was it last year? I think.
Yeah, it was. It was the first year of the Nashville show. This last year.
It was 2 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe it's been 2 years now. I'm not sure. Yeah, that was a good show. When the show is new, I'll probably go back sometime. But, you know, with those shows, it's an investment. You don't really make a lot of money at the show. You lose a lot of money trying to go there. It's definitely an exposure, finance liability that you got to take on rather than an asset. So
yes, for sure. I noticed though, you were, you seem to have it on lock. Like I want to talk to you a little bit about, I mean, we'll get to this, but you seem to have a lot of business acumen, and the way that you worked that show felt very intentional, and it felt like a lot of the guys making cymbals were just kind of, I don't know, we're artists trying to learn how to be businessmen, or we're craftsmen trying to learn how to be businessmen, trying to learn how to be wise with our time, wise with our finances. And that was one thing I noticed from you. Like you had set up getting your cymbals to dealers, whatever ones you didn't sell on the floor was going to go to a shop. And that's something I've been kind of in the world of trying to balance the businessman and the artist, the craftsman, and kind of how those two work together and what kind of balance you find between them. It seems like you've thought that through a lot, and you have a lot of experience in that area.
Yeah. So I come from a family of artists, and I won't get into this too much, but my one sister, she's an art director for a big city, and another sister is a documentary filmmaker who's had stuff on PBS and is, you know, done really well. And what I've learned is when you're in the arts, you still have to figure out how to keep a spreadsheet. And so right now I'm going through the Lean Six Sigma coursework, which that's big in manufacturing, how to eliminate outliers, how to keep your processes making sense, things like that. Eliminate that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So when I do a show, like you gave the example of, I want to know I can at least break even. So I reach out to dealers, and I reach out to players or artists that might be in the area. And I let them know that I'm going to have product local. And if they'd like to check it out, I'd love to have them by the booth. And that kind of plants some seeds ahead of time. While I like making cymbals, I really enjoy making cymbals. It's not a get rich quick scheme. you know, and I would just, I don't know, maybe you're doing all right, but, but to the, you know, the ever increasing number of aspiring cymbalsmiths, man, the materials are expensive. Mistakes are expensive. If you mess up a cymbal, you know, it's not still, you know, all these years into it, I might make a cymbal twice before I'm comfortable shipping it out. Mm-hmm. Or you might start lathing into something and you find problems in it. And so that all goes into the cost. So even though it's an art kind of a thing, even though we may think of ourselves as being artists or, you know, craftsmen, there's a business side to it that's pretty real, that if you want to still be doing it next year and the year after that, you have to think about what makes sense.
So. Yeah. Yeah. That's really good. That's something that, I've had my head in that world. I, you know, for me, it's definitely a labor of love, but having that challenge of figuring out how to make this financially work so that I can support my family. And, you know, you just told me you have a family, you got kids, you know, that's not to be a cymbalsmith and support a family. That's a lofty task. And so figuring out how to do that, you know, you can live so much in the artistry world and just be like, I'm making cymbals like Spiz did. And it's all this mystique and whatnot. But if you don't actually pay attention to, okay, how are you devoting your time and what are you devoting your time to? Are you spending twice as long on this one cymbal when you could have just scrapped it, started a new one, and even made two or three in the time that you've been spending on this one that you're just trying to figure out? If you don't do that, then the longevity thing it becomes an issue. I'm thinking about the sustainability of this. You talked to me at the Nashville show just about resting your hands. You go to do a bunch of hammering, like remember to take it slow. If you start feeling sore, take a break. And I think in the 2 years since then, I've been working on that and realized like it is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And, you know, you spread that time out, you rest your body, you know, you're going to be able to do this. I want to do this as long as I can physically hold a hammer. If that's in my 60s and my 70s, then great, you know.
Yeah. But, you know, my comment on that is, you know, around the time I was telling you that, I'm a few years ahead of you, and my right elbow was really hurting, my thumb was really hurting, my joints. And so I've learned to pace myself where I don't work every day in the shop. And I've cut back, you know, promotion and even pushing sales just so that I can, you know, I have just enough. I don't need, you know, I don't need to have everything. I have just enough that it's a sustainable,
yeah,
it's to be sustainable for me to physically be able to do it.
Yeah.
So rest is a big component. And even the guys in Turkey, I mean, they've got entire, you know, I think those aren't, while we think of them as craftsmen, and they certainly are, it's an entire team of people working together very often. And I get the feeling that maybe there's a group of guys that migrate between different shops and we'll go work. If you watch enough of the videos, you start to see, I think I saw that guy.
Yeah.
Some other company's video, promotional video. And they may really go after it for a few days, like they've got a hammer day, and then that doesn't happen again for a month. Mm. So that's my understanding. I could be wrong, but at least in some shops, that's the I understand to be true, is they're not doing all the same things every day. So there's a rhythm to rest and using different muscles and not wearing out your joints and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I've heard too that those factors will kind of, they'll get young guys in, kind of use them up and then send them out and get a new batch of young guys in, use them up, send them out. And it's kind of the method. And the guys that end up sticking around will become managers and become guys that do some of the finalizing and play testing and stuff like that.
Raiders or something like that. That's not as impact heavy on your joints, that kind of thing. But
yeah,
I can imagine that sounds like that would make sense.
Yeah. So. From a business perspective, I'm interested. So, I mean, obviously we're kind of talking when you're established, I'm interested to know kind of your backstory. I know you went to school to become a luthier and you worked as a luthier for a decade. Is that correct?
Yeah. So for about 11 years, I was in guitar repair. So I went to the Roberto Venn School of Luthery in Phoenix, Arizona. That's the oldest guitar building school in the U.S. So wow. I would say late 60s, early 70s, they started. And I was a drummer. I played drums since I was 10. But at the time that I was getting into that, I knew I wanted to do something in music, but I was more interested in gear at that time and really more how things worked. So it seemed like there was more that could be done to develop a living out of doing that with guitars. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like a lot of guys, I also played a little bit of guitar. So the crossover made sense for me. So I quit college and I went to Roberto Venn and did the training there, and straight out of school. I was very fortunate. One of the guys who, you know, few guys, I was fortunate to get a job at a shop right out of school. So I went to work at a shop in Dallas, worked there for a year, eventually went back home, back up to Illinois, where I worked at a shop called Naperville Music for, gosh, I want to say it was like 9.5 years. And then I did independent for a little while. And I've had guys here in Cleveland, because we don't have, I guess, a lot of good guitar repair here. I've had friends in the neighborhood, guys that play out professionally, say, Ray, you should get back into guitar repair. You should just do setups and fret work. You'd have a ton of work. So I don't know, maybe I'll do that. No promises, yeah. But might get back into that as well. But I also, you know, going back to when I was in junior high, I would get old violins. I'd ask the band and orchestra teachers if I could have broken instruments or whatever they had. So from my band director was awesome. He gave me all these cymbals that just had like minor bell cracks.
Oh, wow. That
they were still playable. He gave me a 28 inch Peisty symphonic gong. It had, you know, it had like a 3-inch crack in it that I drilled the ends in. But I mean, wow. Man, I was like a 14, 15 year old with a Peisty symphonic gong. That was awesome. I had that for a long time. Let's see. I got an upright bass that had a broken bass bar, but it was a laminate top, so it wasn't worth them paying to repair it. So I just tore into just all different kinds of instruments. Ruined a lot of stuff as a kid, not knowing what I was doing. I just learned about instruments. And so that's what led to me eventually getting into cymbal making, is that I actually was building guitars, repairing guitars. I was really interested for a long time in getting into building Selmer McAfee copies, which that never really fully manifested. But if you're not familiar with Django Reinhardt, that was the guitar that he played. You can look it up. I was interested in doing something like that, but you know, because I was always really a drummer, you know, my first passion always went back to drums. I never got as interested in drum building, although I have built a few drums. I was really always just fascinated by cymbals, mm-hmm. because it seemed like such an industrial process. It seemed like impossible. Like how could you make a cymbal? You know, like what would be the first step? You know, who would you even ask? So I was just trying to take in everything I could. And you know, there's that little mini documentary about Roberto Spizzichino,
yeah,
that's on Vimeo. That I think has inspired all the cymbal smiths. And I realized, these guys in Turkey, they don't care. You know, it's like who they're selling. It's like if they're going to sell a sheet of bronze to some, you know, guy in America, they don't care. Fine, just make a little money doing that too. So I just started calling around until I found a couple of shops that would sell to me, and took it from there. And figured out how to build a lathe. I went through many iterations of a lathe. That was kind of one of the tougher parts. But luckily I had some guys around me that knew better than me that helped me figure it out. Ruined a lot of material and, you know, made a lot of trips to the scrapyard, and eventually I had stuff that I felt comfortable putting out in the world.
Yeah. And the stuff sounds amazing. I think one thing, when I knew you, I think one thing that struck me in Nashville was playing your cymbals. They sounded the way I would want a cymbal to sound in front, like 20 feet, 30 feet in front. And I've been fascinated with the idea of kind of as a drummer mixing yourself. And it came from, I saw Bernard Purdy when I was in college, and I got to stand right behind him as he played. And he played in a way that I didn't understand. It was like he was hitting the toms really hard. He was hitting the cymbals really lightly. And it was like, it just didn't sound like a drum. It didn't sound like a groove should sound. And I like naively was like, why are you playing that way? And he was like, oh, I'm just thinking, I'm mixing myself. I'm thinking of how this is sounding out front. Huh. And he was like, you take the low frequency things, they need to have a bit more cut and punch. And so that's why he would hit the toms the way he did. But then the cymbals, he's like, those things are going to cut. So, but then in the world of cymbal smithing, we all like to make these real thin, wobbly, jellyfish like cymbals, and jazz drummers think they need the thinnest thing ever, 'cause that's going to equal dark. And it's weird that, you know, it actually kind of is the opposite. A lot of times you can get thin cymbals that are really bright and really tinny sounding, no stick definition, or it might sound good behind the kit, but then out in front, it's kind of just mush. So I noticed that about your cymbals. I was, my booth was like two or three over, and I was hearing the cymbals, and I was hearing them in a way that was like, I knew that that's the way you designed them to be, was you designed them to sound the way they need to sound as they translate through space. And so, you know, behind it might feel like, for a jazz drummer, it might feel like, well, this is a little bit heavier than I like, but all of that complexity and warmth and darkness that a lot of those drummers want actually needs space to propagate. And that actually got me thinking a lot, and I've been kind of in that zone for a while now. I'm kind of hitting a new level of just thinking like heavier cymbals is kind of where it's at in a lot of ways. So
are you still hammering some bells?
A little bit. Yeah. I way less than I used to, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That, 'cause that's really cool that you do that. And those are cymbals that sounded really good at that show. Mm. I remember, you know, yeah. In terms of how it sounds out front. Yeah. I did kind of come to realize, and there's some cymbal smiths out there now that I think really what they've done is they've designed cymbals to sound good from about 2 feet away to the player, which is great. And if you're maybe in a studio environment and there's a little more control, that's great. But when you think of in a live situation, you know, you get like more than 10 feet away, it in the mix, it does sound totally different. And the thing about what sometimes, like, this is like, how do I say this? Sometimes what customers think they want, and what they really want, you kind of have to like ask more questions. Mm-hmm. Because if you have a really loose, wobbly cymbal, it looks really cool. You know, it's just kind of like eye candy. Or a cymbal that's very, very heavily hammered may seem like a great idea. But a friend of Roberto's actually told me that, you know, you gotta think about what you're doing if you're beating the life out of it. If mm-hmm. if you hammer it so much, you gotta think of what you're doing to the material, because what we're doing, you're shaping the cymbal, but you're also creating, you know what I mean, the different density points. And if
yes,
if you do too much of that, at some point I think you get to the point where you just weaken the bronze, and you can thin stuff out too much. You just kind of got a plan where you're going. There's some cymbals that if I order bronze, that's kind of on the thinner side to begin with, you know what I mean, from for a blank. Because maybe I want to do like a Turk or a half Turk kind of a thing, or do my quarter Turk. And I don't want to have to just be mowing down a lot of bronze off the bottom. There's been symbols where I just, you know, like five or six hammer strokes in the wrong place too many.
Yeah. You're done. Yeah.
You throw it out. It's gone.
It's gone.
It's a funny thing that way.
So that's an interesting thing to think about that, that didn't strike me until I had been doing it for a few years already was the idea of hammering is adjusting the density, but also the thickness of the material. And you have to, that really comes into play with hand forming bells. Cause you're stretching, you're taking that metal and stretching it up into this shape. And then you lay the bunch of weight off and you're, oh no, it's too thin. You like that process of just the hammering has done so much to thin the material out. And that idea. So it's with cymbal making, it ends up being like you got to kind of think, or at least have in your mind, 50 different variables at all times. Like you're going to do one thing for one effect, but you got to realize it's going to have 10 other alternate effects in different areas. So, yes, you put it on the lathe and you shave it, you taper it, you do all that kind of stuff. But that hammering process, if you're not keeping that in mind during the hammering, what you're going to do with the lathing and vice versa, that's when you end up just making mistakes and getting wasted material, because you thinned it out too much or you cracked it or something like that happens.
Yeah. You create a pocket, a unintentional dirt pocket, or, you do tend to hammer more closer to the bell or even like you said, the bell itself. And so now you're pounding it thin, but what you're trying to do is get that convex shape. But now you have to take that into consideration when you lathe and you're putting some taper into the cymbal, so how thick really is it near the bell versus the edge? Cause you want it to be able to release energy, which is important. Longevity of a cymbal as well, to be able to efficiently use the energy and not be overly stiff.
Yeah.
So just last week I had a stash of cymbal blanks that I had done a little bit of hammering on and had just left them for several years. And I had one left, one I gave to a friend and one I had left. And I was like, all right, I'm going to do the special engraving on it. So I got my laser engraver and I'm going to, it's going to be a one of one. And I was so excited about this, like this 20 inch cymbal with like a lower flatter bell. And I wrecked it.
Oh, man.
Even as much as I know now, it can get away from you. And the material has its own limitations. And each piece is different because it's a hand poured thing. And let's face it, B20 bronze is like approximately B20 bronze.
Yeah, approximate. Yeah.
Yeah. And kind of like Turkish bronze is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of, I'm interested to ask you about this because the thing that comes into play here is like, as an independent maker, we're all in some way, whether we like to admit it or not, inspired by Spiz. But then there's also the idea that, and Spiz made, from what I know, he didn't really make like lines of cymbals. He had tributes to various players or tributes to old Ks, but he wasn't trying to say, this is a blankety blank cymbal. I make this in all the different sizes and you're going to get a similar or close thing with each one. So, he's in the very, everything's unique. Everything is, which I feel like it ideally that would be the world to live in, is like, just let each piece of bronze be what it's going to be, and don't try to force it so much into a zone. But from the business side of things, you kind of have to give the customer something they can understand, and you want to give them something that they can digest. And if all you're doing is throwing up random symbols all over the place, it's just going to confuse people. So the idea of having a series, like you have the quarter Turk symbols and some other things that I've seen, like you're creating lines with the understanding that there's going to be variations within these lines. Talk to me a little bit about where you find yourself kind of in that world of everything's a unique individual piece versus production lines like the big companies do it.
Yeah, that's a great question. So Rob Andre, who, if you don't know, he works with me, and I do collab work with them. So we, Rob and I have had a relationship for a long time. We initially met when he was still at Chicago Music Exchange.
Yeah, that's where I met.
He like I brought in like my first batch of respectable cymbals to him, and we had another connection, a mutual connection. So that's how I got my foot in the door. And he's like, here's the thing, Ray, like people aren't going to understand that this is just like this unique symbol. You have to have like a series. You have to like do this, you have to do that. And I was like, okay, like whatever you say, Rob. So yeah. I came up with series after that, and you know, started trying to coin some new terms and stuff just for, you know, like the quarter jerk, because I'm just trying to give an identification to the customer of what that is. And those series are, they are series, but also every symbol that I've ever made is unique. Because I can, again, I can steer it towards what, you know, being similar to something else I've made, but they're all, it's just me, with that anvil and that lathe and the variances in the material I'm getting and just trying different things. I'm learning, you know, so it changes. I'm wanting to try new things, so it changes. I'm doing more and more with very light patinas now. Have been for a while, really. You know, just trying to experiment with different things. But you know, I think what's difficult, you know, you kind of have to put the shoe on the other foot, is how adventurous are you as a consumer? So for example, something I do that drives my wife, I don't know if it drives her nuts or if she just feels embarrassed when I do it. We go to a restaurant very frequently, especially if it's like out for dinner, because lunch, you know, whatever, get a salad or something. But I'll go to a restaurant and I'll look at the server and say, I just want you to bring me some food. You know, don't pick the most expensive thing. You know, don't take advantage of me. But listen, I just want something interesting, different, that I wouldn't have thought to order. And you know what? 9 times out of 10, I'm delighted. And it's really like you get some, like sometimes the it's always like, you know, like a younger server, you know, they'll come back and they'll be like, so I sent back and I was talking to the chef about it, and like, we're not, I'm like, no, listen, like whatever you bring me, it's going to be okay. You know, bring me some food and I want you to have the freedom to have fun with it. You know, the 1 out of 10 times when I'm disappointed is when the server picks something so safe that I would have gotten it for my 10-year-old.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm a guy coming to a restaurant, like a, maybe not fine dining, but you know, a nice enough restaurant, and I'm saying, let's be adventurous and just surprise me. Don't bring me a cheeseburger.
Yeah, please don't.
Yeah. So I think that the customers that guys like you and I are attracting, I hope that there's a little bit of that sense of adventure, that it's going to be different. And I know everyone, they say like they've got that sound in their head looking for, which by the way, I don't think it exists. I think it's like, it's something that there's always like a little bit of adjustment. And so we almost mythologize the sound of a cymbal by saying, you know, I want something that's like smoky and buttery, but there's something crisp about it. And, you know, like, what does that even mean? Who knows? At the same time, you know, you want something smoky and buttery, yet there's something crisp about it at the same time. And, you know, that's the symbols where it's like, okay, well, good thing I have some experience to try and steer this in a direction that I think you want. And that's, by the way, you know, people ask me, how much time do you spend making a symbol? And, you know, part of my question back is like, how many email exchanges do we have? How much time do I spend with you on the phone?
Yeah.
You know, there's people that really, they want to talk through it. But you know, I feel very fortunate. I feel very blessed that it seems like most people that I've had the privilege of working with usually really, you know, really happy with their symbols and make good use of them. I mean, I don't know how things have worked out, you know, the way they have. I'm not very big. I don't move a lot of volume. I have some artists, I have some dealers that I work with that are pretty good. I sell some to individuals. You know, I've gotten on some big albums, which is, you know, it's as though I played on them, but I happen to know.
Oh yeah.
You know, let's see, like the Robert Plant Alison Krauss album that came out a couple Ooh. Years ago. Yeah, so Jay Bell Rose picked up a 20-inch extra light rivet ride.
Amazing.
Nelson Drum Shop that I made. That was like, talk about like, oh man, that's awesome. Like, you know, I just feel like just so privileged. Like, oh my gosh, you know. Matt Chamberlain used a set of cymbals on I think it's 2018 Pistol Annie's album. So that's fun. There's been some other things, you know, through my relationship with A&F and stuff. But yeah, I just feel really privileged, you know, to be a part of something in a small way with people that are way more talented than I am at what I do. And that I get to have just a little part of that, you know, experience. Really cool.
Yeah. So that's something I noticed about the independence that I most gravitate towards and the guys that I respect. There is a sense of, there's a sense of like the thing that's led them where they end up going really is just the curiosity. Like there's like you said earlier, there's such a curiosity surrounding bronze and like how does this metal, how do you make a symbol like this? It seems like so crazy when you start, and then you start and you go, well, how do I make this kind of symbol? How do I make this kind of, and then you start getting into that world, and then you realize that world really doesn't have an end to it. And so what ends up kind of propelling you is just this, I mean, the best way of saying it is just a curiosity for what can be actualized if I just take this hammer and do it in a certain way that might be different than I've ever done it, like might be brand new. And I really resonate with that idea of like kind of throwing away your process almost every few months and kind of just doing something new and changing things and failing. You know, like I've done this for years, I've made hundreds of symbols, but then I just, you know, I made that mistake, cracked that symbol. It's kind of because there isn't really like an end to this art, I say art form, but, and that's kind of why I say art form is like, because it isn't just a step-by-step thing. No. If you have a certain mentality about it.
Yeah. Oh. It keeps changing and you keep learning and, you know, it's kind of like you, you make your first China symbol, you know, like, and then you figure out how to make your first reverse China or Novo China, if you prefer, which I really like those better from a technical standpoint. Mm. They breathe and they move a little better, which obviously makes it a different sound, but I in concept, I like them. I mean, there's just all these things. Even I was kind of snotty towards the effect symbols at first. I kind of had the attitude of, well, this is kind of, you know, like this isn't what I do.
Yeah. But
it's kind of refreshing to just do something fun, you know. I mean, they're actually over my shoulder. That's something I'm working on.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things I'm gonna release that it just for, you know, even if I only sell a handful of them, it's just for fun, you know, just to enjoy. So,
and you'll learn something, like you'll walk away from it and go, okay, I can take that and apply it to the symbols I make, you know, and kind of, it all ends up kind of being part of your bag. Like I just recently started making, I tried to make a little set of like a little batch of 8-inch mini hi-hats, and the bottom one had a flat no bell kind of thing. So you could fit it on a normal cymbal stand. And I sold a couple sets of them, but I had to end up adding like a center piece of steel just so that they wouldn't just have the weirdest tones and something about that kind of material that small, and you're trying to get it to sit flush and not have any weird overtones, was just kind of weird. And so then I took that and kind of recycled those extra pieces I had, started making some like Bill Stewart-esque chime splash things that he uses, like kind of over his flats and stuff. And that kind of took me in a direction. And then at the end of it, I was like, I'll never do that again. But then I took like four or five things, and it's going to apply to the cymbals I make on a day-to-day basis. And it's great. It's like, it's a blast. I couldn't love doing this more than I do.
Yeah. So. And that's the challenge is, you know, when we first started talking, I talked about you need to keep a spreadsheet and it has to be profitable. It needs to make sense for you. It needs to make sense for your family. But you still want it to be fun and something that is an expression of creativity. So I don't know. I've had a lot of ideas about ways to, you know, how do I make this something that, you know, God willing, if I live another 40 years, I could do another 30 of those years, you know?
Yeah.
Like, how is that something, you know, like, do I adapt a model where it's like, okay, I'm going to sell 10 cymbals a month. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about that a lot. You know, do I just make the 10 cymbals I want? Like, again, they could have the series. We kind of trailed off from that original question, but they're just like, this is a cymbal. Do you like it? You know, it's available if you want it. Or I made these 10 cymbals and they're going to this dealer that I partner with. If you like it, you should talk to them. But not trying to figure out how I can ramp up, how I can offer an equivalency of everything. Yeah. I don't know if you ever listened to Seth Godin's podcast called, but he talks about reaching the smallest viable audience. And so I'll be in here hammering, listening to all these different podcasts I listen to, and I'll hear him talking about reaching the smallest viable audience. Like what's the lowest number of people that you can reach to like just get what you need, instead of having this perspective of, well, I need to figure out a way that I can make 50 cymbals a month or 100 cymbals a month and become like this, like a big company. Well, the thing is, there's lots of big cymbal companies and medium cymbal companies that already exist, and they're making good stuff. You know, it's different, but they're making good stuff. I don't have to become them. I don't have to have an equivalency of everything that they come up with, or an alternative to everything that they come up with. I can just make what I want and see if I have, I mean, gosh, for guys like you and me, if we had, let's see, 200 customers, that we're just locked in, and maybe some come and some go, but you've got about 200, I'm just making up numbers here, and they were people that you just kept in touch with, and they bought maybe a cymbal a year from you or something like that. That could be the basis of your small audience.
Yeah.
And that's all. And so you run into, do I need to be making one of everything? Do I need to go to every trade show? Do I need to, you know, promote myself endlessly? You know, I haven't been doing a lot on Instagram lately, in part because I don't really need to. I'm busy enough. Yeah. It's just not as much fun anymore, if I'm being honest. You know,
I'm starting to lose the steam for it as well. Because I post every day. I kind of do like three accounts posting every single day.
Good job at that. I gotta give it to you. I see your content every day, and just so you hear me say it, I think that you're doing great work. I think that your cymbals sound good. They look good. They're compelling. I think that's good. And thanks. You faithfully post every day. But yeah, it does feel like,
it's a slog through the mud, honestly. And then the algorithm changes all the time. So you might have a certain audience and, you know, that you didn't do the right kind of post for your algorithm. So, you know, 10 people saw it and you're like, man, I spent 30 minutes, you know, trying to make this video, and I could have spent 30 minutes hammering a cymbal. You know, that would have been way more valuable use of my time. I think I really am interested in the YouTube thing these days, and just getting, I mean, even like this interview will go up on YouTube, and just because there's like, I think as far as actually reaching the audience, the YouTube thing is really where the people that are kind of interested in a little bit more, you know, they're interested in a little bit of a deeper connection with their, the people that make their stuff. That's where they're going to go for stuff. And it's not really the quick soundbite kind of, you know, I get on Instagram and I see guys that are posting like 3-second clips where they've got a bow, they're bowing a drum head and then dipping a chime in water. And it's like 3-second clip and it's got 200,000 likes. Just like, what are we doing? This is so silly.
That's because really. It's content that anybody who's not a drummer, yes. Like, oh, that, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas what you're doing, you're demoing a product for someone that you're trying to reach that you want to take an interest in and taking a step with that product, right?
Yes. So, yep. And they're going to be the guy that's going to put the headphones on and sit and listen to it 10 times in a row and imagine how it's going to sound in their room with their sticks and the way they play. And they're going to take the time to do that. You know, that's kind of, like you said, I'm really inspired by that idea of find your smallest audience, smallest viable audience. So is that what it was?
Yeah. And I didn't say that. Seth Godin did. So
Seth Godin. Yeah. It's a great thing, and it gets me thinking about the pricing element for cymbals. I've talked to other guys about this because I think in general we kind of all aim our pricing pretty much in line with the top of the line of the major manufacturers. And there's I get different perspectives. I respect all the different perspectives on this idea. On one hand, there's this idea of, well, we are going to take much more time with a cymbal than Zildjian will, and we're going to make sure it sounds the way it needs to sound. So it should demand a higher price, you know, oversimplifying, but that perspective versus the other perspective being, well, we get a bigger slice of the pie because it's just us and we're not having to divvy it out to A&R teams and marketing teams. And you know, that $600, $650 price tag for a Zildjian, that pie is getting divided up in a bunch of different ways. For us, we get a bigger chunk, so it's fine. And then also the customer kind of knows what to expect because they have Zildjian as a reference, so your symbol is kind of the same. I get both of those perspectives. I float between them, and some days I'm like, man, I should charge $800 for this ride. Like it is worth it. I really think it's worth it. And then other days I'm like, who am I? You know, and then you get like all self-conscious and you're like, who am I to charge more than Zildjian or whatever it is, you know? I'm interested to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah. Every couple months, Burke gets on the phone with me. Mm-hmm. He tells me, he's like, Ray, man, you're not charging enough for your cymbals. I don't know. You're probably right. And I look how much everybody else is charging. I'm like, man, I'm not charging enough for my cymbals. And again, you look at the spreadsheet and it's just like, so much margin has been gobbled up. I raised my prices last year and even with my, just to catch up with materials, but that didn't even do it. Now I'm looking at another price increase in my adjustment in my materials. So, just everything costs more for everyone. So yeah. I think that again, that's where it gets really important to, you don't have to sell a cymbal to everyone. You know, you don't have to sell a cymbal to all the famous guys. You know, I know that, I don't know if this is getting off track from the question, but, you know, like a lot of people will be cynical of the whole endorsement thing, you know. And if you've been to my website, you see I do have a lot of artists representing Burn cymbals, but they're, you know, other than Daniel Steele that plays with King's Kaleidoscope, which is a fairly big group, most of them are, they're working drummers, you know, they're making a full-time income, but man, they faithfully represent the product as players, as educators.
Yeah.
They're kind of putting things out there and kind of jumping all over here. Sorry. But, you know, I'm just thinking in terms of pricing and relationships and reaching people that are real players with product how they help produce content that I can just repost, whether or not the algorithm likes it. Just like, here's a real person that actually makes a living playing the drums and he plays my cymbals. Maybe, they play like stadiums or something, but they're really good drummers and they're actually doing this thing, and they play these cymbals. So, I think that's a valid customer testimonial. I don't know. Do you do an artist program at all or no?
I have a very low key one, and I understand, like I've moaned about the artist endorsement thing, because you obviously get people that don't understand that it's a two-way street. And yeah. I think people that
anyone watches, please don't email me. Don't message me. You are no. I'll find you.
Yeah, I'll make it real simple. As an artist, if you just think of it like, well, what can I give to this company? And will the company be willing to give back to me? And it will be a two-way street. That's great. And it sounds like that's kind of what you have. And I think that a lot of guys that have an issue with the whole, and they just moan about, oh God, these people reaching out for endorsements and free gear, and they get mad about it. I think it's because those people probably have been burned by and just haven't put together, taken the time to make an actual program, an artist program that says, yes, you can be an artist, and this is what I would expect from you, and this is what you can expect from me. You know,
also for a business our size, what I've done is everyone has the same deal. Every artist has the same deal, and they're all paying. Nobody's getting anything for free.
Yeah,
it's too expensive for me to give away. And also, it goes back to the scalability of being a craftsman-based business. Let's say you did have a very high-profile drummer that, for some reason, said, "Hey, if you will give me free cymbals, I'll give you this kind of exposure."
Yeah.
Is that sustainable for your business? Is it ready to make that switch? And would that even provide that? I don't think it would.
Yeah, it's interesting that because you from a business perspective, if you were to give a symbol out for free, you would have to, just the mindset, obviously for us this is a no duh statement, but for most people, you got to understand, if we were to give you a symbol, we would need to be calculating that the exposure of it would sell us enough symbols to pay for that free symbol we gave you plus additional profit. And we would have to know we would actually make money that we could provide for our families with based on you getting that one symbol. So what does that mean? Does that mean 5 symbols sold from the exposure of your video? Does it mean 10? That's kind of the perspective that has. Yeah.
It's really hard to quantify. It probably really doesn't really work. For businesses our size, it doesn't. Yeah.
So to answer the question, I do have an artist program, but for me, I just tell people, like, I like to develop relationships with guys. And so if we, if you're interested in this and you can say, I'll throw up a couple posts, I'll talk about it, I'll whatever, then I'll give them a discount, an artist discount, like you, it's the same discount. Then if they get it and it's like something they like to use, they use it on their gigs, they like to talk about it, and they do talk about it, then that's the formulation of this relationship that can then be ongoing. Sometimes it's like, you'll give a discount out and the person, you'll never hear from them again. And you go, okay, well, that was, a little bit of a waste, but you just pick through the weeds, I guess. Not calling people weeds there, but you kind of get through, you have some experience where people don't actually want to continue the relationship, and that's fine. That's what it is.
Along those lines, though, it can feel a little, like you realize that they're copying and pasting the message to everybody.
Yeah.
So getting on with different symbol makers, there's one guy that he talked to me about you. He was calling me, and then I heard from another symbol maker that he talked to him and another guy. And so he was just doing the rounds through, we won't say who, through all the symbol makers. And I'm like, man, like, just, that's fine. But like, don't sweet talk everybody. Like, you know, like you're offering us the world. And,
yeah,
you know, so I think it, what it really comes down to is it needs to be a relationship of respect. And you're trying to make a living. The player is trying to make a living. You know, they're trying to, you know, work with a brand. But I think when players aren't to that point in their career yet, I don't think it's about building their career so much as it is about emotional validation. I think that it's just like getting like 1,000 likes on something, you know, that the emotional feedback of, guess what, guys, I got, you know, I got this endorsement, you know.
And yeah, that was what it was for me. I got when I was in just out of fresh out of college and playing music, I got an endorsement with one of the companies that makes cymbals in Turkey, and it's like a different company that has, you know, a factory there, just basically makes them, slaps their logo on it, and it, one of those kind of companies. And it's like, yeah, we'll offer you an endorsement, and then you're like, I'm a young, like just fresh out of college, like, oh my gosh, I got an endorsement. And
made then, it.
Yeah, I made it. And you, I was just spending, I was still buying the cymbals and they were still making the profit they needed. And the model is actually like to get as many endorsees or endorsers as possible, you know, and they're still selling and they're still making a buck. And then, you know, they're kind of feeding and preying off of that, what you just said, kind of the idea that I have an endorsement and what that means, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It only takes you so far. It only means so much.
Yeah.
It's gotten to the point where you do kind of wonder what it does for you, what it really matters to some people.
Mm-hmm.
But guys that I'm working with, you know, I think there's a mutual respect. That they're good at what they do, and I'm really happy to be able to work with them in a professional and personal collaboration around the music. So
yeah,
I think that is where it's, when it's a relationship like that, it makes sense.
All right, so we just took a little bit of a break because there was hammering in the background and it was a little bit loud, so sorry if that was coming through too much on the audio. I had a question. Because we talked about, okay, I remember what it was. We talked about, you said the pricing, you're getting into the pricing thing, and you landed on something that sounded to me like you want to price your cymbals in a way that working drummers can afford them.
Yeah.
Is that a good way of putting it?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of been my conviction to holding back my pricing from probably more where it should be. Is that I want to keep it realistic for working musicians.
Mm-hmm.
It's always kind of been my, you know, just my pull.
Yeah. That kind of is the thing that sort of pulls me away from that idea of like just going gung ho and just charging a super high ticket price for a cymbal. Is that like, is, you know, and it's no problem if a doctor comes and wants to buy a cymbal from me. But that's not really my target audience, is doctors and lawyers. You know, I want anyone to play my cymbals, obviously, but if they could be in the hands of working drummers, I mean, I spend time agonizing over the sound of these and would they work in music?
Yeah.
Obviously that's the ideal place that they would exist, you know?
I think to your point though, it's, having players of all, you know, different levels and, you know, time and interest is great. I think it's maybe the question is, if you don't have enough working drummers, you know, what does that do for your brand development long term? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. So yeah.
You need that vote, I guess, in one sense of the word.
For sure. Yeah. I have asked this question to, I think every cymbalsmith I've talked to. What is one thing, or maybe a couple things, that you wish that the average customer, the average drummer knew about cymbals, that would make the process of of them getting a symbol from you and even accurately describing what they want from you that would actually make that process easier?
I'll put it this way. I appreciate when customers understand it's a small business and they understand, if I give them, the scenario of I'm waiting on materials and, now with the earthquake in Turkey, which is terrible. It seems very underreported on the news, by the way.
There's like 33,000 people dead or something like that is what I heard.
It's incredibly shocking.
Yeah.
That's a national crisis of incredible magnitude of the country that I get my material from. I was up next on their production list and, got to give them time to wrap their heads around what just happened. And, there's just so much like that. Then, once I do have the material, that I can pace myself for that, I probably reject, now with my best supplier, I still reject about 10% of what I get or more, because I just want to, put good product out there.
Yeah.
So if I don't feel comfortable with it, I won't keep it. If I have to make something twice and that's on me, I'll absorb that. I forget, what was your original question?
I confused it a little bit.
Yeah. I'm sorry, for customers understanding just that there's so much that goes into hand making a symbol, for a business that, just like any business, things that go wrong. On paper, we should both be doing incredibly well, but the reality is just like any small business, you just have to always be overcoming these challenges. So,
yeah. Well, Ray, thank you so much for the time. I feel like I could probably talk to you for another like 4 hours, even like getting into the minutia of like symbol terminology, but we'll save that for maybe like an in-person discussion or maybe a future podcast. We're both going to be in Chicago. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're having a, kind of a independent symbolsmith specific event at the Chicago Drum Show, which is May.
I want to say 20th and 21st.
I don't know where the details of where it's at, but you can look up chicagodrumshow.com. And there's, I think, 8 independent symbolsmiths are going to be there. They're going to do a Q&A, and I think all of us are going to have booths as well. So I'm sure I'll catch up with you there. But thank you so much for taking the time to chat.
Yeah, you got it. I appreciate it.
Yep. All right, guys, this has been the Reverie Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.